and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshenworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world becomes increasingly digital and interconnected, understanding hidden drivers of human behavior becomes essential for designing effective ecosystems, whether in space missions, organizational transformation, or innovation adoption. Today, we're exploring invisible forces that shape decision-making and how quantifying the implicit mind can revolutionize everything from AI model accuracy to space exploration attitudes. We'll examine how unconscious biases and emotional responses create both barriers and opportunities in complex systems, and why traditional explicit data captures only a fraction of the behavioral intelligence needed for truly adaptive ecosystems. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshenworks, and joined today by our guest, Dr. Aaron Reed, founder of Sentient Decision Science. Aaron, let's start with your journey from experimental psychology to pioneering technology that qualifies the subconscious drivers of behavior and decisions.
Thanks, Diane. It's nice to be here with you today. I'm very excited about the conversation and bringing some of this knowledge around the implicit, the non-conscious to a broader audience. Where would you like to be me to begin on the journey? What would you like to hear about first?
Maybe just hit the highlights. So, How did you find this kind of passion project that is Sentient Decisions, and what kind of led up to this mission that you're solving for today?
Well, for me, there's nothing more fascinating than human behavior. I find people endlessly interesting. And so I studied psychology at Middlebury College as an undergraduate. And a lot of people don't think of psychology having broader applications outside of clinical psychology. But there is a rich world literature on how humans behave outside of the tales or the abnormal psychology that most of us think of when we think of psychology. And so after my training at undergraduate, I went into business because I love business. And what I found in business, I was working in DC within the telecommunications industry after the baby bells had split out and the government was interested in ensuring there was competition in those telecom markets. I was working and trying to understand how consumers made decisions. And it was so obvious to me that we really had no idea. And the best practices we had at the time were running surveys, asking people, why do you do what you do? What will you choose? And I was an analyst and observing this data come back from asking people the drivers of their behavior. And quite honestly, it was not very rich and ultimately not very accurate. And so I said, if I really want to make an impact, I need to understand how people really make decisions. And that was the start of my journey on a deeper path for psychology. I went back to graduate school and studied an area of interest of mine, which was how emotion influences behavior. And I'll pause there for a second before I give you some of the gems from my study in human judgment and decision making.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And I think what I believe we're going to kind of find and share with our listeners is that just the increasing importance of your areas of study on, because decision making, right, and behaviors are happening in a much more interconnected way, and change in life is coming at us more quickly than it ever has, right, in this digital era. Yeah. And so the understanding kind of what underpins decisions, actions, and not only is important for kind of the innovators and the designers who are kind of building new systems of within industry, policy, and society, but as actors in these systems, we need to understand how this information is affecting the environments around us and how we can make better decisions within the context of this rapid change. So, yeah, excited to unpack your work in this conversation today.
Yeah, that's great. And I completely agree. And as we build these systems, the assumption is that humans are rational actors. And there's 50 to 60 years of research within the behavioral science literature that demonstrates we are systematically irrational. And that word systematically irrational, I think, is really key here for this discussion. So you may know of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky's work. These were two pioneers in the decision-making literature that were early inspirations for me. Danny Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on heuristics and biases, demonstrating how humans are systematically irrational. And the key to that was demonstrating an assumption that we all made, which was that humans operate according to the rational economic model of behavior, that we're always something called utility maximizers, and that we have complete knowledge and we are consistent in our decision making. And you can tell just from the description of that, that it doesn't actually describe how we make decisions. And I love this phrase from that work: the rational model of economic behavior may be prescriptive. It may be how we should make decisions, but it's not descriptive. It's not how we actually make decisions. And when we're thinking about building systems, if we do understand how people are systematically irrational, we can design systems that incorporate the natural way humans interact and the way that they make decisions. So I think it's a perfect setup for that.
Yeah, I love that. I think that really just kind of sets the stage for our listeners, right? Because so many of our listeners are innovators. They are product designers. They are platform designers, right? They're market makers. And so they're probably assuming a lot of that rationality, right? And that kind of prescriptive, they're relying a lot on their data, which is, as they're going to hear in the next hour, may have a lot of holes in it, right? So, yeah. So maybe touching on your work, and if I may kind of just lead us to that proportion of emotion model, can we walk our listeners through some of that foundation kind of work that will set the stage for some of the kind of the implications and applications that we'll be talking through in the latter part of the hour, but maybe walk through some of your foundational work.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you some of the genesis of that, the proportion of emotion model, as it's called. And we published this in a journal article, Journal of Consumer Decision Making, Journal of Judgment and Decision Making, as emotion as a tradable quantity. And this was a model that was the first to mathematically combine measurements of emotion, physiological measurements of emotion, with cognitive trade-offs mathematically in a single algorithm to predict behavior. And I'll tell you the genesis of that. In graduate school, my interest was how emotion influenced choice. But my advisor, Claudia Gonzalez-Vallejo, was a mathematical psychologist. And so she pushed me to quantify. And so I did. And we started to investigate how might we measure emotion. And emotion at the time was something that was ephemeral, was fleeting. It was something we understood as important, but couldn't get our arms around. And the way you used to try to understand that kind of real human experience was through qualitative approaches, in-depth interviews, focus groups, that kind of like, hey, let's talk about it. And we'd get good insight, but not quantities of emotion. So I started to investigate ways to quantify emotion. And there are many ways to do it. I mean, you can do it with scales. There are plenty of those in the literature that show faces or images of humans, and you sort of select them. You can do it with a physiological response, such as galvanic skin response or heart rate variability. Those are measures of arousal or the degree to which you're sweating in your palms that can indicate a degree of emotional reaction. You can do it with frontal asymmetries using EEG. So alpha wave activity in the frontal lobes, there's an asymmetry for approach versus avoidance processing of stimuli. And I started to investigate those different measures inside the labs at Ohio University and got these quantities of emotional response. In those same experiments, we also measured the rational trade-offs, the symbolic cognitive trade-offs that people were making. And since we had quantitative data at the individual person level that was both emotional and reason-based, we could build a single algorithm that combined those data sources to try to predict what people would choose and what they would do. The early studies applied this to financial decision-making on stocks, short and long positions. It applied it to things that college students were interested in, like dating choices. And it applied to things that were obviously emotional, like the purchase of a diamond ring. And from those studies, early studies, we showed that if you measured emotion and combined it as a weighting mechanism, mathematically, you're more accurate in predicting people's preferences. And that was the early foundation for that work. And we started to test it against other models. So we tested it against Kahneman and Tversky's cumulative prospect theory. And what we found in that side-by-side comparison was that when you included emotion in the equation, we actually outperformed Kahneman and Tversky's cumulative prospect theory in predicting a separate data set. That was a big breakthrough academically. And I'll stop there and talk about the application outside to business, but that was some of the early foundational work on quantifying emotion and how could we use quantities of emotion to predict behavior.
That had to be just a stunning breakthrough at the time, right? It's something that was so ephemeral, right, if you will, to be able to really kind of shape that into models had to be just a real kind of pivot in the trajectory of how decision science progressed from there. And you have maybe if we kind of double click into that. So and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but you've demonstrated that implicit data, right? If we focus on implicit data, can improve predictive accuracy pretty substantially, right? And if we think about the implications on decision science, right, the changes, the improvements that you have been able to achieve, right, using some of these models and data, the augmented data, is extraordinary. We deal with a lot of folks who are in the aerospace industry, as an example, where just a couple of points, basis points improvement in model accuracy is meaningful, right? So maybe walk our listeners through some of the model improvements that you've been able to achieve by incorporating some of the more implicit data.
Thanks. Yeah, I'd love to. And I think part of the key to being able to predict human behavior at scale is to be able to have scalable measurement solutions. And so I mentioned the physiological measurement and the neuromeasurement EEG lab-based work that we were working at the university. When I came back out into business and started Sentient Decision Science, we needed a measure of emotion that could be easily globally scaled. And the organizations that we work with have global footprint, and we need to be able to measure human consumer emotion anywhere in the world where someone may be. So instead of turning to physiological measurement like heart rate and how much you're sweating in your palms, we turned to the implicit association literature. And implicit associations are your non-conscious mind. It's what happens automatically in our minds. It's that you may have heard system one and system two thinking. Again, Kahneman made that very popular in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, in 2011. The implicit mind is essentially spreading neural network activation. It happens automatically without our control. And the inspirational article on this was Chartrand and Barge from 1999. It was called The Unbearable Automaticity of Being. I thought that was, they were at NYU at the time. And that was the inspirational piece. And for me anyway, and they showed in that work that we are often unaware of the true drivers of our behavior and often not able to control that implicit influence on our behavior. And so psychologists around that time had developed a measure for studying stereotypes and biases. And this was Banaji and Greenwald, and it was Russ Fazio at OSU, some of the early academics on this. And they needed a measure that could quantify the degree of bias that somebody felt towards another group of people without asking them any explicit questions. Because, I mean, imagine you're studying stereotype or biases, and you ask somebody, hey, are you biased towards this group of people? What are they going to say to you?
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. They're going to say no. And they're going to say at least for two reasons. One is they may not want to tell you, but actually the bigger reason, the more pernicious problem, is that they're not actually aware that they have the bias. It's unconscious. It's implicit by its nature. And so these psychologists had developed a response time technique that used priming and response times down to the millisecond to measure the degree of implicit bias towards another group of people without relying on any explicit questions. The classic example is using, if you're studying racial bias, using black faces and white faces paired with positive and negative words and asking somebody to make quick judgments to which is positive or negative. And then you swap the positive and negative words between the black and the white faces, and you look for the latency in response. And that latency is an indication of the cognitive accessibility or the hindrance of the task. And that latency tells us, quantifies the degree of implicit bias. So we looked at this back in 2007 at Sentient, and we said that technique can be applied to any concept that someone may not be able or eager to admit. Let me give you an example. So we looked at that and said, all right, well, let's try to apply it to a new product development and launch. And we had a great client at the time, Macy's. You may know that retailer here in the US. And they were interested in launching a new product line. They had a new designer for one of their brands. And they were concerned, this was a brand that they manufacture and merchandise themselves. They were concerned that this new design may be a little too edgy for the conservative consumer base for this particular brand. And so they came to us and they said, hey, Sentient, can you tell us whether this product is going to be successful or not? And it was dresses and pants and those kinds of garments. And we said, yeah, we can. Absolutely. And let's measure it the traditional way with some rational trade-offs and just see what people choose. But let's add in this implicit reaction, this automatic approach and avoidance emotional reaction to the products using our application that was now on desktops, laptops, and ultimately mobile phones. And so we measured the reason-based or rational response to that, those products. We measured the emotional reaction to those products, and we combined them using that single algorithm. From that set, we were able to make predictions on which products were going to be successful. And the good news is that the consumers actually did like these products. But we had run the study in April, and it was for the May line as well as the fall line. They had already done the buy for the May line. And if you're in fashion, the buy obviously means you already have sourced all the product. You know what's going to go into stores. And so they put the product into stores in May. And at the end of that month, we asked them, they say, hey, could you give us that sales data? We just want to see how much it correlates, right? And so, all right, so we ran the correlations and we looked at how the rational data correlated with the actual sales of the products. It was a whole line of products. And it was pretty good for the statisticians on the line. The R square of that model was 0.69. So it accounted for nearly 70% of sales, 69% of the actual sales. But when we added emotion into the equation, the R square value went up to 94.94. Meaning we were able to account for 94% of the sales by incorporating this implicit emotional reaction to the product. And that's profound when you think about model fit. Now, again, for your listeners, this isn't like retrofitted data and freely varying parameters. This is a priori predictions measured before an outcome and correlated after that outcome. So, and this study ended up getting a lot of recognition in the industry because of its predictive accuracy. And let me just put that into financial terms. When we think about that from a manufacturing and merchandising perspective and think of it within ecosystems and efficiency within ecosystems, on a single garment, if the retailer had that improved accuracy in predicting sales, they save, on average for this particular study, $60,000 to $80,000 per garment. Because what happens to your product when it doesn't sell during the season? It ends up on the clearance rack at 80% off. If you could optimize according to more accurate prediction of what people want, you can have profound impact on the profitability, the efficiency of the manufacturing and supply chain, marketing decisions and merchandising. That was a great example, early example of the power of quantifying emotion and the implicit mind.
It's amazing, amazing. And if we think about just the really the high stakes of placing bets, making investments in this environment of rapid change, right? You have to rely on decisions with the benefit of the data that you have. So to the extent that you can increase the confidence level in that decision-making mechanism, given the rapidity with which change is rolling through markets and across ecosystems, what innovator, what product manager is not going to try to stack the deck in favor of better decisions? So yeah. I'd love to maybe extend the kind of horizon of the implications of what we're talking about here and reach to that generational study that exploration that your team has done really and it's very timely because we have a burgeoning space economy and folks are making long-term high stakes bets on the development of the space economy. Everyone is thinking about what a space economy means to them, for them. And you've done some really interesting research on that. I'd love to have you share that example with our audience.
Yeah, I love this study. And we do these types of studies often simply to understand the human condition, how people truly feel and how their thinking and beliefs are affecting their thoughts, behaviors, and well-being. And so this was a study that we ran. This was in 2021. So we were still in the thick of COVID in the US and the implications of that. And so it was a generational study where we wanted to understand how people were feeling about many topics. And we had over 2,000 US adults in this study, and we split it across generations. So we studied attitudes of Gen Z, millennials, Gen X, and then sort of older and younger boomers split into two different groups. And we were interested in understanding how they felt about a lot of topics: work, the economy, money, climate change, politics, COVID-19, space exploration, perceptions about their future, empowerment, social media. So we were studying a lot of different topics, and we weren't simply asking them questions about it. We wanted to measure their automatic positive and negative feelings toward these topics. And we found fascinating differences across the generations on some of these topics. Just to give you a sense of like, hey, this implicit stuff really works. Their associations with social media. Who do you think has automatic positive associations towards social media? And who has automatic negative associations towards social media? Which generations?
Yeah, a pretty good point. And it really, I think, an interesting study, right? We have such an emotional reaction or relationship with our social media. I think folks like me are a little bit more cynical than the digital native, the social media group.
Exactly. And the data showed us that. It was like a very strong immediate positive association with social media for Gen Z and millennials, little less for Gen X. And then boomers actually have an implicit negative association with social media. And so then we look at like space exploration as another area of interest and ideas. And wow, we saw very different results. When we measure the implicit emotional reaction to space exploration, actually Gen Z and millennials were slightly positive. This was around the time where Elon Musk was getting a lot of news and attention for SpaceX in 2021. And Gen Z and millennials had an implicit positive reaction to the idea of space exploration. the strongest positive associations were with boomers. And of course, this is the generation that saw the first person on the moon and the launch of inspirational space program. But where do you think Gen X fell? Yeah. I always ask you, you're the person supposed to be asking the questions when I'm asking.
No, so this is a conversation, and I feel like I'm cheating because we had this conversation. I was shocked by the answer, but negative, right?
Negative.
Or kind of nudging negative, if you will, which I thought was fascinating. But it's logical. Share with our listeners the reason for that. I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, well, when we think about the different exposure that these generations have had to the space program and the idea of space exploration, as we mentioned, the moon landing for boomers is something that's forever etched on their mind. Something that emotional, that inspirational, shows you what emotion really is. Emotion is a memory cementing mechanism. The most emotional moments in our lives are the ones that are the most memorable. It essentially adheres those positive associations together with the event that incited the emotion. And when you think about that for Gen X, what was the most significant space, emotional space moment for Generation X? It was the Challenger. And that I remember it. I remember being in school. I was, I believe, still in high school at the time. It was in 1986, just getting into high school at the time. And we stopped that day. It was traumatic for a lot of people. Yeah. And again, in the negative direction. And so when you think about that as an implicit attitude, belief that needs to be overcome in order to motivate people behind an idea, get investment in an idea behind space exploration, it's a very real implicit bias that needs to be addressed. And there are ways to address it. But being able to identify it and say, hey, there's a negative implicit bias here, is the first step to changing attitudes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's so important. And when we're all preconditioned to be efficient, A to B, right? Move fast, make decisions. But if we stop and reflect on the experiences, right? And a mentor of mine once told me, and this will stay with me really throughout the balance of my professional career, I know, but he wisely advised me that every touch point matters, right? So it's the experiences, right, that imprint upon our kind of our memory and form a lot of our frames, our perspective, right? The way we view and interact with the world. So it's understanding those biases and perceptions. It helps us, I think, interact more effectively with not only decisions, but the world around us. Yeah. I'd love to touch on one of the other case studies that you had shared as we were kind of approaching this conversation, but I thought it was fascinating as well and will be helpful for our audience, which includes innovators and product designers and system designers, but so research on physician bias, I thought was also fascinating and surprising for me, but I'd love for you to share that story with our listeners as well and maybe the context for that study.
Yeah, thanks. I love that study too. It's a great illustration of the intersection of implicit psychology, business, and human health outcomes. And so this was a study that we completed, and it was being done and sponsored in support of a new product launch around migraines. But the sponsor of this research understood that there was a significant stigma around migraines that was going to need to be overcome in order for this product to be as successful as it could be. And stigma starts with stereotypes, but it becomes actually not just an association. It becomes a negative mark. It's on an individual. And that stigma is not only a mark from the outside, but it's also generated self-referentially. If you have migraines, if you suffer from migraines, you have an implicit bias that is not positive towards your self-image often. That's often the case. And so in order to effectively address the go-to-market strategy for this new product, we needed to understand the type of messaging that was going to be most effective to reduce this stigma, and not just among patients and their families and among coworkers, people that they interact with, but among physicians as well. And so you can imagine if you're trying to study, just like we talked about with like racial bias, if you ask a physician or a neurologist, a primary care physician or a neurologist, hey, do you have a negative association towards your patients with migraines? They're not going to say yes, right? Of course not. Of course not. Yeah. So we had to turn to the implicit measure to truly understand, is this stigma that we know, sort of generally humans, day to day, your coworkers may have against people with migraines, is that also true for physicians? So in the study, we measured the implicit associations of migraines among coworkers, people who work, among patients, among family members, the general population. And we also measured it among primary care physicians and neurologists. Now, I love this because the primary care physicians, the neurologists, supposed to be completely data-driven, right? Objective, rational, completely data-driven. But we see this in all of our physician research. Doctors are human too, right? And we're all subject to this implicit bias. And so when we measure the associations with migraines, those associations tend to be things like lazy, selfish, weak. Those are the automatic associations with migraine, people with migraines. It's terrible. And if you look at the associations among patients, they actually have an automatic association of selfish with migraines. Think about how terrible that is. Somebody who's suffering from migraines implicitly feels like they're being selfish because of the migraines. That's a terrible human condition to have to live with. Not only the physical pain, the debilitating pain of a migraine, but now you've got this self-loathing that's going on because you feel like you're acting selfish. And how about lazy? And how about weak? I think one of the most striking things from that study was that primary care physicians and neurologists had the highest, the strongest associations of lazy with people with migraines. And think about how that can affect your patient-doctor relationship. Now, rationally, it shouldn't, but implicit bias influences our behavior without our knowing. Right. And so by revealing that true implicit bias, not just among the general population, but among physicians, we were able then to identify the messages that could help overcome that bias and lead to more effective treatment and raise awareness within the medical community around the extent of that stigma. I just love that study. Human health outcomes, successful new product launch, and an optimization of messaging to change attitudes.
I love that example. I could imagine that easily extrapolating to really anyone with chronic pain, right? Yeah. Which is so prevalent, right? So the work that you're doing is so important. And frankly, can be, I see this applying to so many industries just in the few examples that we've walked through, but I know there are many more just in the conversations that we've had leading up to this discussion today. You've shared so many fascinating examples. And I also love the example that you've shared in the past regarding the Nissan electric vehicle, which is such a departure yeah. from that health outcomes, but a fascinating application. I'd love to maybe have you share that example with our listeners, but also just the patterns that you've seen across the many sectors within which you've worked.
Yeah, sure. I love that one too, Diane. That one's, yeah, like you said, it's a little different than the migraines, but there were actually some positive health outcomes, or at least we'd like to believe it, from the Nissan study, but it was more about pedestrian safety. And this is a great study. We did it in collaboration with our partner Made Music Studio, who designs sounds for brands. And in this case, we were the measurement of the potential sounds for Nissan's fleet of electric vehicles. And if you remember a few years back, I think this was 2018 when we did the study, Electric vehicles were a big departure from combustion engine-based vehicles, which had very clear sonic cues about whether it was accelerating at you, for example. You could hear the loud muffler, and it was a cue to get out of the way. But with an electric vehicle, there weren't any sonic cues to whether a car was backing up, whether it was accelerating towards you, and that was both outside of the cabin as well as in the cabin. And so the objective of the study was to create the sounds for Nissan's electric vehicle fleet that had instinctive, intuitive meaning for the pedestrian, fit with the brand, there was a brand outcome for it, but also the third objective was to do it without adding what Made Music calls sonic trash into the environment. And I love that outcome because we can grab people's attention in very annoying ways. You can imagine a sound of an electric vehicle that makes sure that you get out of the way, but now suddenly all of the vehicles are making that sound and our environment, our sonic environment is full of trash. And so by using this implicit intuitive measurement system, we were able to identify the sounds that had implicit intuitive meaning for acceleration, reverse, etc., fit with the brand, and did it in a way that was pleasant. So we weren't adding sonic trash to the environment. I just love that. And so if you think about that across other applications, those kinds of outcomes are common. We understand not only what is going to be most predictive of behavior, but we have a deeper understanding of why. And that's where you see the fundamental explanation of behavior cross-cutting industry. Because if you understand the fundamental drivers of behavior, not just what people say, but if you understand the drivers that are unspoken, now you can replicate solutions in novel environments. If all we understand is, hey, this worked in this context, and we don't understand the drivers, the mechanisms behind driving that behavior, all we can do is replicate it in that environment. If we get deeper into the mechanisms, the subconscious and the emotional mechanisms that actually drive behavior, now we can reproduce that behavior in a novel context that's more efficient. It's meta-level knowledge on behavior. And really, it's what's missing when we think about the future of the information that we're getting out of artificial intelligence. I don't know if you want to go there yet, but that's where this, I think, naturally leads.
I completely agree with you. And actually, that's the perfect segue, I think, to the artificial intelligence and kind of ecosystemic operating models, right? Because the world is much more interconnected and distributed, and change flows through those systems within society, within industry and policy, much more quickly with greater reach than it really ever has, right? So understanding those having the meta level knowledge and the underpinnings of decisions and actions is going to, I think, help us design systems that lead to much more beneficial experiences and outcomes. So let's maybe go there. So let's talk about your recommendations for our listeners who are either designing or interacting with those systems of change and those AI enhanced systems. What should basically the designers be measuring? What data should they be thinking about incorporating into their systems design so that they can make better refinements with this enhanced set of understanding?
Yeah, I think it has that macro, the last 2.5 years with generative AI and the explosion of and wonder around it, and then explosion of use around it by the individual human. Billions of people now using ChatGPT, OpenAI, Gemini, Claude, other solutions, broad solutions to query, to find information, but also to generate content, which they're then reposting. It's amazing in terms of what it's able to generate and the efficiencies and the potential that it has to bring in terms of production, productivity. But as we all know, there's a lot of challenges and potential danger in the development of these systems. And you know, I'd love to talk about the really important article that came out in Nature last year by 2024 and all. And this was an article that was looking at something called model collapse. And in this work by the authors, they were testing generative AI models and their outputs when these models were trained on successive generations of data. So what I mean by that is a generative AI model produces, it's based on a core data set, the original source data, and it generates data based on that original model. Now, that original model has some accuracy in it, and it also has some inaccuracies in it, right? But that the generated data that comes out of that can then be used to train the next generation of model. So think about this from like a perspective of how we're scraping data from the internet today. And how that data that's being scraped from, be it X, any other public source to train a model, is being used to train the next generation of models. Well, some of that data has been influenced by the previous generation because we're now using those generative AI models to post ourselves. So if the nature of the data that's now become public and it's all written or spoken word, not even the non-conscious yet, if that data is becoming increasingly infiltrated by generative models of the past, it has the potential to be what we call it a regression to the mean. I'll give you an example from this paper. As the authors continue to train the next generation model from the output of the previous models, the new generation models were more perplexed and they had less variance, meaning there was less certainty around what they should predict and there was less variance in what they would output. So think about that. If there's less and less variance, what are we doing? We are essentially regressing to the mean. There's less variety in our output.
Right.
And I believe that human nature is beautiful because of its variation. And so if our models are producing less and less variable data, we're becoming more and more the same. That's a big danger for the future of AI. So I pause. I've got more to say there, but any questions so far on that
yeah,
piece.
You know, I would imagine you're about to answer my question, but so how do we safeguard against that and protect the magic that is the diversity of the human condition, right? And
experience.
So how do we maintain that rich diversity and the integrity of the models, so to speak?
Well, one of the answers does come from that article, and I would encourage everyone who's doing this kind of work to read this article, Nature 2024, Shmailov, and all. We'll put it in the notes. Yeah. What the researchers found was even when you inject just 10% of the original data set into the training of the next model, you improve that model. You reduce its perplexity and you increase the variance. Now, it's not perfect. It's still worse than the first model because it's a model by its nature. It's not going to be the original. And that, I will emphasize, is just the written data. It's just the spoken word. And as we've been talking about, the spoken word, the written word, the conscious rational does not fully explain the human condition. And so what these AI models truly need is an injection of the implicit. These models are actually trying to model the implicit mind, their neural networks themselves. And implicit data, true implicit data, is the actual capture of the implicit mind. So if we can begin to inject implicit data at scale into large language models, they're going to become more representative of actual human decision-making and therefore more useful, less biased, if we have all of the implicit data in there, not just selective biases, and they're going to become more human. We could debate whether that's good or bad, but I would say a non-human AI that is rapidly regressing to the mean is a much worse outcome.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you there for sure. And too, I think that gives our audience, the designers, the innovators, the futurists in our audience, a lot to kind of consider in their design plans, right? And my goodness, it just opens up a lot of questions too, but there's so much development being done in this area. And it sounds to me like a very urgent need for our audience to be factoring these design elements in as they're executing their work. If we could maybe just switch gears just ever so slightly. And in this series, we've had a lot of those innovators and researchers and futurists kind of come in and share their work with us. And in doing so, we've explored a range of arenas, kind of from the space economy to some of the more taboo topics in science and the human experience. So we're exploring unexplained phenomenon like UAPs, like a kind of faith-based observations, miraculous phenomenon. We the last episode that we just recorded explored magic and mentalism. And we've also had folks in who have remote viewing experience. So really, our listeners and our guests are pushing boundaries. They're innovating, they're creating, they're researching. So they're looking to those next horizons and placing bets on investments in new product development, new research. So you have touched on how implicit bias can factor into decisions and actions. And maybe if we can explore how these implicit biases and emotional responses can also help prevent serious investigation of potentially viable observations or breakthrough innovations. How can we help our audience strike the right balance between healthy skepticism and curious investigations by putting the right emphasis and weights on and maybe understanding of bias in decision making, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I love that question and application of this. But I think it's important for the audience to just maybe hear again the implicit bias, even though when we say that, it's interpreted as negative because we think about racial bias and gender bias, those kinds of things. But implicit bias is really just a systematic tendency towards one direction or another. And so it can be positive and it can be negative. So in either direction, it is by definition non-rational. It is an automatic response. It's not reason-based. Its original source may have been reason-based, but now it's implicit, which means it's not going through reasoning. It's an automatic reaction. And so if we understand implicit bias from that perspective, that it can be positive or negative, and it's by nature not rational, we need to address implicit bias through messaging, through perhaps non-rational argumentation, but rather through associations that open the mind and reduce the weight of that implicit bias on a decision maker. If you have an automatic implicit negative association with a topic and someone begins to try to make a rational argument to you about it, you're automatically shut down. Can we approach it from an angle that opens up the mind, that doesn't go directly at the implicit bias, but opens up wonder rather than reason and curiosity rather than reason-based argument? Does that make sense? As a way in and to begin to mitigate that natural implicit bias.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It's actually a brilliant revelation. I'm thinking about many of our listeners who are very, very accomplished professionals, right? So they have long tenure and great success in their careers, and as such are oftentimes very efficient in making decisions and taking action towards a certain goal based on their current set of software, so to speak, if you will. And one of the last conversations that we had in a previous episode, talked about that, how that success can create certain blinders. To your exact point. So some of the most accomplished professionals may have some of the most ingrained set of blinders because they have really in their careers been conditioned to make decisions with a certain set of assumptions.
Yeah.
So how do we help those folks walk back from and unlearn those assumptions or at least understand when they need to challenge those assumptions and hypotheses and maybe look at the world anew? My business is named Shoshin Works, the beginner's mind, for a reason, right? Because we have to be ready to or understand when we need to unlearn some of those assumptions and hypotheses and embrace a new lens of what the world offers.
Yeah. I'd love to give you a couple of examples on that, just maybe for your viewers to bring this to light on hard to change attitudes. Can I talk about climate change? And I'd love to talk about a related topic on that on emissions. Just two quick examples. I think you may find this interesting. So we did this really interesting research on how to effectively communicate on climate change to motivate people who are not motivated around climate change. And we tested a lot of different advertising and approaches to that, some of which were very alarming and showed images of forest fires and California burning and a lot of red imagery and smoke and the other outcomes, negative outcomes of climate change. And it was a bit more shame-based. It was a bit more, hey, you ought to do this. How can you turn away when you're looking at all of this stuff? And what we found in that study was that message was reaffirming for those who already were pro, but it actually drove the people who were not pro climate change and addressing it in the opposite direction. It offended them. It made them personally feel not that they wanted to change their attitudes, but that they were going to stick their heels in. In contrast, messages from mothers talking about their children and positive steps and teaching and outcomes that were about their children's future, not with images of burning forests, but the connection between the mom, who was a scientist, and her daughter, made an emotional impact that was more effective among the group of interest, the group was trying to persuade. So both of those are emotional messages, one much more effective than the other, because it didn't try to directly change the attitude. It tried to make a human connection arise, emotion in a place that's hard to deny, the relationship between a mother and a daughter. And that was more effective tactic in changing those attitudes. Second one is, again, against emissions. And I love this one because it's just so practical. This was a study on, could we get consumers to pay a little bit more for a fuel additive that had pro-environmental outcomes? It was reducing emissions from combustion engines. And it was done here in the U.S., and we tested different messages to understand which message is going to be the most effective to get the people to spend a few more cents a dollar for this additive. And we tested things like it reduces emissions by 30%, 10 more miles to the gallon, UN approved, and tested the effectiveness of each of those. Saves you 7 miles a gallon, something along those lines. And well, first of all, the message on the UN, I don't know if your viewers want to hear this or not, but it actually was a deterrent. People were less likely to buy it if we heard it was UN certified. Fascinating. That was general population US, not everybody, obviously, but on average. But you know what was most effective? It wasn't reduces emissions by 30%, which is really remarkable. And that was the actual stat and science-backed stat. It reduces emissions by 30%. It was 7 more miles per gallon. And why did that work? Because it hit them where it mattered, in their pocketbook. I'm going to get 7 more miles per gallon. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to do this. And so that's counterintuitive, right? Because if you're behind that movement, you want people to be pro-environment, save the world, right? No, save me money is sometimes the way to get the behavioral outcome that you want. Does that make sense? Sorry. I love those examples, but that's attitude change. It's a complex. I don't think there's anything more complex than human behavior. Maybe that's why we love to study it, because it's endlessly interesting.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. And incredibly impactful, right? For the teams that you're working with, you're unpacking something that is very mysterious and elusive to them. And they've got a lot at stake in what they're building. Actually, great segue to my next question. So for our listeners, I just have two more questions for you. And then I swear I'll let you go. But so this is such a fascinating conversation, but
I could talk all day. Yeah.
No doubt. But for our listeners who are ecosystem designers, orchestrators, product designers, innovators, whether they're designing space mission architectures, innovation networks, or the next social network platform, what is the one insight about implicit behavioral dynamics that could fundamentally change how they're approaching their stakeholder coordination and value creation? What advice would you have for them?
Stop relying solely on what people say. The spoken is half, if that, half of the equation. The unspoken is where your breakthrough insight is going to come from. Observe behavior, do it scientifically, and measure the non-conscious mind. You will be leaps and bounds ahead of your competition.
Yeah, good advice. Great advice. And then if we could just for a moment look in the crystal ball, kind of looking at the convergence of implicit behavioral intelligence, AI enhancement, and ecosystemic design. What excites you most about the possibilities for creating truly adaptive, behaviorally intelligent, and beneficial ecosystems over the next 5 to 10 years, 50 years? What excites you most? What are we unlocking that could be most impactful?
I think emotion is a universal human currency. It is our currency for trading. We rationalize it. We represent it with money, but really we're trading on emotion. And the ability to measure emotion on any smart device anywhere in the world opens up the ability to understand what people truly value. And if we are injecting ecosystems, processes with an understanding of what people truly value, those systems are going to become more valuable to humans. They're going to become more efficient and they're going to get us to a place of human equality more quickly.
So right. We talk a lot in this series about the infrastructure of truth and trust. These interconnected systems really run on infrastructure of truth and trust fundamentally. And that emotional currency is what everyone is plugging into, right? We have to, the human experience really is all about that. So I think you guys have a pretty good compass that you're helping your clients, your teams really discern better decisions, take better actions. And we're grateful for the work that you're doing and the perspective that you've shared here today. I know it's going to be very helpful for a lot of folks in our audience. So again, cannot thank you enough. This has been a fascinating discussion and I think we could have probably talked all day, but with that, we'll wrap it up there. And there have been a lot of great references in our conversation today. We'll capture those in the show notes for the folks if they want to study more. And again, I just thank you very much for your perspective here today.
Thank you, Diane.
Yeah, for sure. And for our listeners, again, thanks everyone for joining us again today as we have explored the hidden behavioral dynamics that shape our ecosystemic futures. Please do, as always, check out this season's episodes as we continue examining how understanding implicit human factors can transform our approach to complex system design from Earth to Mars and beyond. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. And as always, you can learn more at shoshimeworks.com.